Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. We have another great show for you today. We're off of Martha's Vineyard. Some people in the peace community are working on the International People's Declaration of Peace, or the IPDOT. If we can't get governments to do the right thing, then we're going to do the right thing with each other. And so we're very excited about getting the International People's Declaration of Peace going. We have a great soapbox for you today. We'll be speaking to Rosa Clemente, who ran for vice president on the Green Party ticket in 2008. So when we come back, we'll have Rosa on the phone. This is Cindy Sheehan Soapbox here at CindySheehanSoapbox.com and 1360 AM Rational Radio, Dallas, Texas. We'll be right back.
We demand transparency. The Conference on Peace, Truth, and a New Economics, happening in New York City this 9/11 anniversary.
Come interact with the top experts on 9/11, the mystery of the anthrax attacks, and the real history of the Bush family.
We demand transparency.
What does the USA really stand for?
Why are the American people not allowed to know where their bailout dollars went?
Why can't the city of New York have a real investigation of the 9/11 attacks? Come help demand government transparency.
Come help create a time of peace.
We demand transparency. The Conference on Peace, Truth, and a New Economics.
New York City, September 12th and 13th. WeDemandTransparency.com.
What was that again?
WeDemandTransparency.com.
Cindy Sheehan's new booklet, Myth America, examines two distinct groups of people that clearly show that we are not all in this together, as President Obama declared. The first group, the robber class, are wealthy victimizers such as those corporations and politicians that profit off the hard labor of others through economic theft and violent exploitation. The second group, the robbed class, are the victims, such as those who work multiple jobs just to make ends meet, those who send their children off to die in robber class wars, those who lack proper health care, those who are denied decent education, and those who lose their jobs and homes and become homeless. Myth America exposes America's robber class, which controls our government, and affirms that we, the robbed class, can only be robbed if we allow it. To obtain a copy of Myth America and learn how we can take back our country, please visit CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you're listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.CindySheehansSoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Thanks for hanging on with us. As promised before the break, we have Rosa Clemente. Rosa is a community organizer, independent journalist, and hip-hop activist. She was a vice presidential running mate of 2008 Green Party presidential candidate Cynthia McKinney in the 2008 U.S. presidential election. Clemente was born and raised in South Bronx, New York. She's a graduate of the University of Albany and Cornell University. Clemente has been delivering workshops, presentations, and commentary for over 10 years. Rosa, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be on.
Well, I'm really excited to have you on. I know that there's a lot of great energy that happens when you and I and Cynthia are together. And, you know, it's just like women, strong women getting together that really know what the score is. And like I said earlier when I introduced you, you were Cynthia's running mate for 2008, the Green Party ticket. So that's an incredible accomplishment for you. You are brilliant, an incredible young woman. But how did that whole process happen that you received the vice presidential nominee from one of the major third parties here in America?
You know, that's an interesting story, so I'm glad you asked it, because I'm sure that some people in your audience might probably never heard of me. You know, I come from the South Bronx. I grew up in the South Bronx in the 1970s. I grew up when hip-hop began right here, and unlike a lot of my cousins, I was able to leave the South Bronx when the crack epidemic came. And that leads me to the Green Party. It won't be my whole life story. But in saying that, even though I grew up in New York City in the 70s and 80s, I grew up under President Reagan and all this. I wasn't an activist. I wasn't. I grew up in New York City. I didn't even know who the Black Panther Party was, who the Young Lords were. I never heard of an anti-war movement. Mm-hmm. I never heard of SDS, or the list goes on. So when I went to upstate in Albany, New York, the capital of New York, I was just a freshman, you know, probably like any other woman of color on a majority white campus, trying to find their way and identity, stuff like that. And I joined an organization, and the following year I became president of this organization. But while I was going to school, I really got mentored by a lot of greats in the Black liberation movement. I was mentored by a woman by the name of Vivian Gordon. I met Leonard Jeffries, John Henry Clark, Kwame Ture. The list goes on of all these amazing people that I never even knew existed. And when I graduated from Cornell, I went to Cornell in Ithaca, New York. I got my master's there. I spent 2 years there. I began to just be a community organizer, and I moved back to New York City. I spent a couple years in upstate New York again, working in the New York State Assembly. I had always had this keen interest in civic engagement, even when I was a younger kid, like how to make things better for other people. And I spent basically from 1998 when I left Cornell to last year, 2008, those 10 years, I was a community organizer really around police brutality, around the freedom of political prisoners. I've done a lot of work on the Mumia Abu-Jamal campaign, then did a lot of work around Vieques. I was at the battle in Seattle in 1999, so I went to World Trade Organization protests. And in 2001, I went to the UN Conference Against World Racism. That's where I met Cynthia McKinney. And I met, you know, progressive people who were elected officials. And Cynthia was one of the few elected officials at that time that was really taking seriously the power of hip-hop politics and activism and what that means. And in late 2003, with a bunch of other really great people in my generation and within hip-hop activism, we formed the National Hip-Hop Political Convention. We wanted to show the power of particularly young people of color coming together to hold elected officials accountable. For some people, the convention was about electing people into office. For me, I saw it more as how do we hold people accountable, how do we run third-party candidates. I've been a Green since 2000, so it wasn't something new that I just became a Green and then I was running. I had supported Ralph Nader in the past. So that basically led to just me and Cynthia developing a relationship. She would invite me to the Congressional Black Caucus in September, these big conventions, and I talked about hip-hop activism and political prisoners, and she kept inviting me to events, and she became known within the hip-hop activist community as, like, the elected official. Like, Cynthia is the one that is, out of thousands and thousands of elected officials, highly respected in the hip-hop movement because she has always respected our politics and our way of doing things that may be different. And I was supporting Cynthia when I knew she might be running. I was obviously not an Obama person. I was one of the few people in hip-hop that was kind of saying we need to take a step back. You know, it doesn't necessarily always matter the color of a person, but really where their politics and ideology lie. And I thought that Cynthia was calling me to help her do a fundraiser, and she called me and asked me to be her running mate. And at first I said no, because I knew what it politically would have meant to me, even within the, quote, left movements in this country, of the lack of support that we would get, particularly as women of color. You know, so I was a little apprehensive, which I'm usually not. But then I said, you know, I'm not voting for Obama. You know, I don't have a problem being that opposition in my generation. And it's not a hate thing. It's a policy thing. And I said yes. And 5 days later, I was at the Green Party, and I got the nomination. And I accepted. And the day after, I was on the road until the election.
Well, we'll talk about our mutual experiences and federal campaigns later, but you made an important distinction there that, you know, why should we support Obama just because he happens to be a person of color? You know, that's like me supporting Hillary Clinton just because she happens to be a woman. You know, she it's her policies. It's not her gender. It's not her race. It's not about Obama and his race either. It's about the policies that we should oppose. And, Rosa, I don't know how many times I get called racist from the so-called left because I criticize Obama. And I said, but I supported Cynthia and Rosa. They're the people that I want to be sitting in the chairs. And, you know, it's not because they're women. It's not because they're women of color, but it's because their platform was something that I supported, not, besides the fact that, you know, you are both very courageous and not political hacks, or you don't your life isn't run by political expediency like the two-party system. So what can I say to people who say, well, if you're criticizing Obama, then that makes you a racist?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it's hard to see that sometimes when you're not a person of color in this country, because, you know, of the history, i.e., like, Cindy, it may be difficult for you to be like, yo, you know, God, you just don't get it. I mean, it could be Rosa making these policies and I'd be opposing her.
Absolutely.
But I think because we live in such a society that race has always been the most prevalent ism, along with capitalism, in this society, you know, and I think, you know, it was difficult for people who are my friends who I went to jail with to pull a lever for me, you know, and then I think it just gets to this whole idea of what does it mean to have, for the first time ever, a black man to be the president of the United States, right? And for some of us, we would say, well, that just means that a black man is the face of the American empire.
Right.
But, you know, when you look at the majority of the people, and particularly working class people, poor people, particularly poor people of color, it's almost like he can make this better. He's only selling out this part of what he promised because that's the way electoral politics work. And in a way, they get that, right, that all electoral politics at some level are corrupt. It's all about, seems so many times to be about compromising what you're willing to give up, your principles and all that, and they get that too. My answer to anybody who, I mean, nobody ever said, oh, Rosa, you're racist, because obviously I'm a Puerto Rican woman.
Right.
But, I mean, believe me, I got the many hate emails from people within my own organizing sphere, which is hip-hop activism, and I was surprised because I figured if anybody's going to be the opposition, the hip-hop political movement is. Why? Because the history of hip-hop politics is to always go against power. So at some level, even the hip-hop political movement should be radical enough to say, maybe Rose and these people shouldn't be running for federal office if it's all based on an electoral college. You know, like, we really analyze deeply those politics. So, you know, I don't walk away from people ever, but my point is I don't have to say anything anymore. The proof is in the pudding. Like, what do we have to say? Look at health care. Look at Afghanistan. Like, let's just get out of the emotion and get to the real subjective truth of what's going on. But for people of color, that time is not there right now. And in fact, before I had this interview, I was speaking to one of my mentors, and he said, we have to readjust the movement. The people are not where they were even 4 years ago. You know, so how do we readjust the reality of where the movement is at, and how do we attack what we're seeing? And I said, you know, that's the thing right now, that right now particularly a lot of so-called middle class, even working class, particularly people of color, they're not trying to hear anything bad about Obama. But on the same level, I think that, you know, once you keep backtracking on everything you've kind of said you were going to do, at some point, what do they say, the wolf is exposed or it's naked, or, you know, it's just going to be him and his policies. And I think what can eventually happen if we had a real third-party movement in this country, not just the Greens, maybe a new party, but a third-party movement in this country, that those Americans that keep saying at this point they don't want to be a Democrat or Republican, I wish that the movement of real progressive people, that we could organize so that those people that are disaffected come into the fold, and at least electorally we could do some really great local work that could hopefully impact the federal level. But I think one of the biggest things we should be doing now is really tying in this fiasco of health care reform with the ratcheting up of troops in Afghanistan, and that we haven't made the connection clearly that we would have enough money to do what we needed to do for people here if we would stop this war,
well,
wars in general.
You know, this is the thing, is like you said that, you know, we have a person of color. He's just head of the U.S. empire. Well, we know that about 27,000 people a year die in the United States because they're ill and they don't have access to health care. I've never seen a statistic, but I would like to know how many of those 27,000 people are people of color. Also, when was the last time in this country that we didn't have a war that was inherently racist? So
right.
We have these racist wars. We're always killing people of color, the other, people that aren't our religion, people that don't, you know, speak our language, people that are darker than us. I think the only time that we have it in this country is the Revolutionary War, and maybe in World War II, when we were at war with Germany. However, we only got into war with Germany because Japan attacked us. So, you know, isn't Obama clearly, to me, still promulgating these racist wars and these racist economic policies?
Yeah, I mean, that's not even, I mean, I don't think for people like us that's debatable. You know, I just think that the psyche of racism, of institutional white supremacy is so deep that at this point, like, if I was just to be one of my cousins or anybody in my community, I would be like, that black man cares a lot more than any other mother white presidents did. And I know that might sound simplistic and it doesn't, you know, give that great political answer, but that's the reality of how some people are thinking. You know, some people are saying anything is better than 44 white men. Anything is better, you know, and then some white folks think anything at least is better than George Bush. But you know, I think there's a great population in this country that's still lulled, you know, and I don't know what crisis it's going to take. You know, I don't know when that breaking point is, but I know that for particularly communities of color, it's coming really rapidly with this recession that we're still in, you know, or I don't even say recession, the falling of capitalism and how it's affecting communities of color, how it's affecting the health care that poor people have to get, that they get through the government right now. I mean, the things that I'm seeing, the stories that I'm hearing don't lend itself well to, like, say, Obama's doing this, he's not doing this, it's impacting your daily lives. It hasn't gotten to that point for some people. For a lot of people, it hasn't gotten to where his policies are still affecting us badly. I don't know where we're at as a movement. I think, you know, there's been a lot of things taken out of the movement. It's almost a deflated movement of people in separate kind of silos figuring out what the hell do we do next? What are we doing? What is the strategy? What's the plan? Where are the young people at any level involved in any movements? You know, and that's what I'm kind of grappling with now myself on a really basic level.
Well, it's hard to, you know, there's many movements that we really need an integrated movement, of course,
yes.
for peace and for economic justice and things like that. The movement, first of all, allowed itself to be too stratified with the Iraq War, never talking about Afghanistan. And it's hard if you're talking about the peace movement because many large organizations in the peace movement worked to get Obama elected even when Obama promised to escalate in Afghanistan. That was just a blatant promise that he made. And then when we would ask people in the so-called peace movement why they were supporting Obama, because he supports escalating Afghanistan and doesn't support a complete and speedy withdrawal from Iraq, they would say they hope that that was a promise that he didn't keep. So now we have a movement that their guy is in the presidency. So how difficult does that make it for the so-called movement to get out and protest?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that's the most difficult part right now. I think part of it is, you know, I think people need to realize that a lot of these movements are also funded. You know, they're funded by, personal people. But they're really a lot of are you know, I could go down the list from my own personal hip-hop organizations to, you know, United for Peace and Justice, Code Pink, you know, great organizations. A lot of them are, first of all, get a lot of money from the nonprofit world. And having worked in the nonprofit world, I mean, at the ACLU and Amnesty, some of the top organizations, one of the things I realized about the nonprofit world is they're there to manage things. They're not there to actually solve the crisis. So Code Pink, a great grassroots organization, comes up. It's women. If they, or let's say United for Peace and Justice, or let's say Hip Hop Organization Number 4. Well, Move On for me was never, I don't think they ever said they weren't a Democratic front. You know, like, I remember when Eli started Move On.
They never said it, but many people in this country from the corporate media on down to the person living in Idaho believe that Move On is like the leading anti-war organization.
Right, or they believe, some people believe that, you know, United for Peace and Justice, which has done great work, but, you know, in any movement when some of your money is dependent on the foundation. And the
right.
And the thing that I learned, one of the things I remember at college is my professor would always say, you should read the book, and then you need to read the history of the person who wrote the book. You know, and I look at foundations and I go, who runs them? Most of them are democratically tied at some level. You have to work with a democratic official to, you know, so like interests get skewed. Is it really about stopping the war, or is it about managing some aspect of it that we think we can manage well? Like, we'll have war, but then we'll have centers for Iraqi refugees, which never really happened. That being said, if you can't self-fund your movement and self-determine your own financial hold of a movement, you're beholden to other interests. And I'm not saying that they do that on purpose.
Well,
I think
yeah.
That's one part of it.
Well,
now, for those that don't
friends, but it's just very, you know, it's very discouraging to me that the movement is politically controlled when the people who are dying, you know, have no interest. They have no even... They don't have any stake at who's president or who can, what party controls Congress in this country. They're just dying. They're just being destroyed, while the establishment anti-war movement is more concerned about the Democratic Party than they are about flesh and blood. Well, Rosa, we're going to have to take a short break. So when we come out of the break, we'll continue this conversation. This is Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. When we come back, we'll finish our conversation with Rosa Clemente. Stay tuned.
My name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you're listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
Cindy Sheehan's new booklet, Myth America, examines two distinct groups of people that clearly show that we are not all in this together, as President Obama declared. The first group, the robber class, are wealthy victimizers such as those corporations and politicians that profit off the hard labor of others through economic theft and violent exploitation. The second group, the robbed class, are the victims, such as those who work multiple jobs just to make ends meet, those who send their children off to die in robber class wars, those who lack proper health care, those who are denied decent education, and those who lose their jobs and homes and become homeless. Myth America exposes America's robber class, which controls our government, and affirms that we, the robbed class, can only be robbed if we allow it. To obtain a copy of Myth America and learn how we can take back our country, please visit CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Thank you for staying tuned to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. We're speaking to Rosa Clemente, who ran for vice president last year in 2008. Very pleased to have her on the show.
Oh, I'm honored to be on the show with Cindy Sheehan.
last time I saw Cynthia, I said, boy, we really need to get together more.
I need to come out to see you and Cynthia on the West Coast more.
I hope so. That'll be awesome. We just really need to work together as much as we can. I want to go over some things that you talked about in the first part of the interview that some of my listeners, even though I think I have the smartest listeners on the face of the earth, I think that they might need to have a little refresher or have you tell us what you meant by some of the things. You said that you were an activist around the whole Vieques issue. Can you tell us about that issue and where it stands and what's been happening with the courageous, you know, community in Puerto Rico?
Yeah, well, Vieques is part of Puerto Rico. It's off the coast. And for those that don't know, Puerto Rico is a colony. We were invaded in 1898 by the U.S. military, U.S. government. And in 1917, we were made U.S. citizens without a vote ever being taken. We're considered a commonwealth, which essentially means we have an association with the United States government, i.e., there's a lot of companies on the island. Especially, people may not know this, Cindy, that almost, if not all birth control, contraception, all of that is always tested in Puerto Rico. It has some of the most pharmaceuticals because of the tax breaks on the island.
Oh, and, I didn't know that.
There's a colonial history to the island. So in the early 1920s, 30s, they began to use the U.S. Navy, began to use Vieques, which is off the coast, again, of Puerto Rico, as a training ground, military training ground. And for 67 years, people were, you know, fighting day in and day out to get them out of Vieques. and to stop, obviously, them doing test runs and all of this stuff, because what was happening in all these test runs, like every day they were using depleted uranium and it was falling into, like, the ocean where, you know, people are fishing, they're eating the fish, and I think at one point 40% of the people in Vieques, or not half, all had cancer. And major, major birth defects. So in 1999, in April, while doing a bombing exercise, they dropped a bomb on a civilian that was a guard. His name was David Sanis. And this moment just brought the Vieques movement back together in this sense that in Puerto Rico, there's movements of people who think Puerto Rico should be free and independent. I'm one of those people. There are people who believe in statehood. There are people who believe in keeping this Commonwealth status. And with this killing of David, all these three groups put aside that, you know, that political difference to really come together and build this movement to get the U.S. Navy out of Vieques. And the movement grew, you know, to the point where Al Sharpton and, you know, major people like him in the African-American community and the white left community began to take arrest, and there were massive civil disobedience on the island here in New York at the United Nations. You know, it was a three-year hard movement. And then on May 1st, 2005, the U.S. Navy finally left Vieques, Puerto Rico, and I had actually been really active around Vieques. I had gotten arrested twice for Vieques, but I also, because I was doing a show on WBAI, which is Pacifica Radio in New York, I was on the island that day, you know, so it was a pretty amazing victory. First, you have this island of people who kicked the biggest military empire out, the U.S. Navy. Second, I was there with former political prisoners from two generations, so it was like really a moment where I tasted victory, and that's part of why I think I continue to do the work I do, because people can win, you know, and it was a really integrated movement, and it was a very left movement, and it was very diverse. I'm talking in every diversity of category, race, ethnicity, gender. It was an amazing, you know, 3 or 4 years of working on that. So that's what Vieques is. Unfortunately, what is actually happening now, and in late April, there was a subcommittee hearing of the U.S. Navy, and they want to reopen the island. They want to reopen training. They said that they need Vieques back. And, you know, Vieques has been fighting, too, to be declared a Superfund site for environmental cleanup, which hasn't happened yet. I think, Cindy, you would know, but, you know, people in your audience, you're talking about, there are still bombs on the island, you know, unexploded. Right. You know, they're still cleaning up. They're still depleted uranium all over the island. And it's still a struggle around that. But I find it fascinating that under the Obama administration, which he has said to the Puerto Rican people, he will make the issue of our status an issue in his presidency. It hasn't come up yet. But that they had the subcommittee hearing of even thinking about going back there.
Wow, so it's the same struggle that our brothers and sisters are having in Hawaii. You know, about, first of all, that their land was taken over and subsumed in the United States, but Superfund sites from the U.S. military all over that island, but especially Pearl Harbor, and here in San Francisco, there's the Bayview Hunters Point area that I've done a lot of work around, and it seems like the environmental community is also kind of working together with the peace community, realizing that the U.S. military is the biggest polluter in the entire world. If it was a country, it would be number one.
Right.
So our struggles are so intimately connected. And talking
they
about
are.
You know, connected struggles, you said you also worked around the case of Mumia. And tell us about what you've done and where that stands under the Obama administration now.
Oh, well, Mumia Abu-Jamal, again, I go to a rally in 1999 with 15,000 people who stopped Mumia from being put to death. And I was really blessed to meet Pam Africa, and to this day call him mentor. You know, I think where the Mumia case stands, unfortunately, is It's already been kicked down by the Supreme Court. I know that Obama will never say anything. I mean, we can see just how he handled this Henry Louis Gates situation to
right.
know that he is not going against the Philadelphia police or the Fraternal Order of Police. And the hope with Mumia lies in what's been going on, the struggle of the people. And if anything's an example, you know, Mumia's not out, but the one thing Mumia says is he's not dead. And believe me, they would rather have him dead. And I think the Mumia cases are really, like, it's another gem. Like, unfortunately, the goal is to get Mumia out always. But it's also an important goal to make sure he is never put to death, and definitely to make sure it never happens under an administration of color or so-called moderate liberal administration. What has happened, though, is that the NAACP, which obviously has an ear to Obama and Ben Jealous has, you know, can, I'm sure, make a phone call to the White House, is finally supporting that Mumia should be completely off death row and free. And people wouldn't think, but for a long time, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, and a lot of civil rights organizations have not supported Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Why is he on death row, Rosa? Refresh the my listeners.
Yeah, Mumia was a Philadelphia born. He joined the Black Panther Party at the age of 14. He would then become a journalist for the Philadelphia Inquirer at, I think, like age 21. He began to monitor the police brutality issues. People in Cali know police brutality, yes. New York, yes. Philadelphia had its own brand of police brutality in the 70s and 80s. It was a man named Frank Rizzo that was the police commissioner, then the mayor, very brutal. Mumia began to cover police brutality on his beat as a reporter, and he began to know the Mu family, and he began to like the ideas of John Africa. He joined the Mu family, the teachings, the philosophies, and one day he used to drive a cab late at night in the Philadelphia area. And all we know is that an officer was murdered, and Mumia, it has always been said that Mumia did the murder, but there's been a witness that came forward a long time ago that said he didn't do the murder. Mumia's been incarcerated since 1981, and is considered a political prisoner, and probably one of the most well-known political prisoners, not only here, but internationally.
Right.
The work around Mumia is pretty incredible.
I know the movement. I know Pam Africa. I know the people
yeah.
who... It's such a positive movement, and they're just always so, you know...
Loving. They're very loving people.
Yeah, they work for justice. They're working for justice
yeah.
for Mumia. They're working for justice for me. And
yeah.
that's just, you know, basically the long and short of that. And so we just have to really always support that cause. And I've had members of the San Francisco 8 on my show before. They did exactly the same thing. They monitored police brutality in San Francisco. And when there was a chance to frame them, they were framed through torture. And, you know, fortunately, most of them have been, you know, the charges have been dropped. And
seven of them, except for, yeah. Francisco Torres. I'm actually, one of my political prisoner mentors is Jalil Muntakin.
Uh-huh.
The thing about the San Francisco 8 case that people don't know, too, is that that murder that they try to pin on all of them in 1971 had absolutely no evidence.
Right.
But they were completely victims of the counterintelligence program. They were some of the most well-known Panthers throughout the country. Jalil was 19 and leading an incredible movement of young people in the Black Panther Party. And I visited Jalil a lot when he was in New York. Now that the case has been dropped for seven of them, except again for Francisco Torres.
Right. Cisco was just on my show.
They let him out.
Ago.
Yeah, Cisco.
Yeah.
That one thing Jalil said to me is that, you know, really they would have rather them all got, you know, died in these various shootouts that were perpetrated by the police. But Jalil has been locked up 38 years. I mean, You know, so that San Francisco A case was, again, another victory, you know, because they were not trying to let Jerry Brown, the DA, really did not want this case to go. I mean, you're talking about 38 years of a murder with no physical evidence and the millions of dollars they spent to extradite them, have them locked up the last 3 years. But, you know, again, it was the movement, you know, that got made sure that them charges got dropped. We just have to work on Cisco, making sure, you know, that we don't let one falter because seven got out.
And that took almost 40 years. So, you know, we're in this definitely for the long haul because there's so much injustice and violence and poverty around the world that we can't ever give up. And we don't have very many victories, so we definitely have to celebrate the victories that we do have. Let's go back now to our, you know, both of our forays into federal electoral politics. Uh-huh. I came out of my, you know, race against Nancy Pelosi with about 17% of the vote, about 50,000 votes in San Francisco, which, you know, wasn't bad considering all the obstacles that we have, that we both had to face, you know, getting on ballots, the obstacle about being shut out of debates or being shut out of the media and things like that. But I came out of my election just firmly convinced that what I call the robber class owns the elections. They own them lock, stock, and barrel. And especially in the federal realm, it's really hard to break in if you're not a member of one of the two robber class parties, the Democrats or the Republicans. So my whole new impetus is to move forward and trying to get people elected locally on local levels that where we can see the most change, where we can actually have more effect on what happens, and to really not just forget about federal politics, because unfortunately that's not possible, but to do more organization locally. What was your experience? Everybody that's listening to my show knows my experiences of running against Nancy Pelosi. Tell my listeners what it was like running for, you know, vice president in this robber class electoral system.
Yeah, I mean, I think I came out with the same conclusion. You know, so first and foremost, I'm of that total school of mind about local, you know, and what local can mean and how one local community's victories can, like, transcend to the rest of the country, that eventually will either knock down this electoral college, open it up for other parties. So I'm sure I had all the similar experiences that you did. You know, first everybody's really happy, and then 3 weeks into it, you know, I can't support you, I'm sorry, you know, you can't be on this panel, or we had to cancel this interview, or, you know, kind of like the sabotaging begins, the not getting on the ballot, the having to pay a fee at the last minute that the county clerk didn't tell you about. Like, people don't hear that part. And when people don't hear that part, they don't understand the lengths that the Democrats will go, the Democrats, I said, to go to keep anyone else out at this point, you know. So I think I administratively and what it means to run in that non-emotional way, I'm sure they were the same thing. On the other level, as an activist, I never was frustrated because I feel like I have a good understanding of the system. This stuff never has frustrated me. I definitely have passion, and, of course, we get angry and we can make, you know, speeches and all of that, but I've always, and probably because I worked in the New York State Assembly and I got to know how corrupt people were, and this was in the early 90s, and I said, oh, this is how it works. This is where change really happens. So on the emotional kind of political level, I think that's where I had the most fun, because I was exposed to, or people, particularly white left people, were exposed to a hip-hop politics. So for me, you know, to be able to say, no, I'm hip-hop politics, you don't know what that is, let me explain it. Here's a book, here's 50 organizations, and to understand that there is a generation out here that comes from this politic that is ready to go to the mat for what they believe in, too. So in that sense, I just felt really, like, blessed, like, you know, to be at the DNC, to be on stage with you or Cynthia, to be at the RNC. I just feel like it's an experience that what 36-year-old from who went to the South Bronx gets, like, you know. So I learned a lot, and I left with the same impression that you did, that it's never going to be the president or even a congressperson at this point that gives us more than what we can do locally.
Well, you know, not only that is that even if say I did get into Congress, you know, what would I be able to do on the
inside? You would be stopped at every level. Like, they stopped Cynthia and they stopped Kucinich,
right?
Wolseley, you know, and I think that's the frustrating part too. But I'm glad that people like me and you who ran for the first time see it quicker. You know, like, people are like, do you want to run for Congress? I'm like, for what? So I could be the only green in Congress?
Right.
And then get voted out and, like, you know. But I do want to say one thing that I feel like I should mention is one of the things that was most upsetting, there were, you know, a couple things for me, was the so-called progressive left media.
Right.
And their complete denial of covering me and Cynthia, and then even covering you and running against Pelosi. Because it should have been covered, because you're basically, it's basically like, if you look at it, which I think we need to tour now that I think of it, it's Cynthia McKinney running for president, Rosa Clemente running for vice president, and Cindy Sheehan running for what would be the third spot, you know, the Speaker of the House, you know.
Right.
So it's like, if we looked at it like that, and if people have respected us, especially women in left and progressive media, that should be having me, you, and Cynthia on all the time. I found that to be the most problematic, and to me it's still kind of the craw in my bone. Like, how the hell does the Huffington Post not write one story on Cynthia? How
right.
is the Nation not putting us on the panel? How are you and Cynthia not on Bill Maher? You know, like, that to me, because I also have become this media junkie in the last 5 years and have done reporting from Katrina and South Africa with Pacifica, even Pacifica Radio, which is a great network. We should have been on there daily at different levels. And so when you have the media that we do have some control over, the progressive left, and I mean black, white, Latino, Asian, all progressive media or those that hold that title really let down an electorate by not informing them of these three women that were running for the three highest seats. Whether you like it or not,
right.
the truth is we ran.
Right.
And we have every right to be heard, and we have every right to be debated, and we have every right for people to like us or not like us, but we should have had a right to be heard. So I just wanted to put that out there, because when we support independent media, let's make sure that independent media is not going down the road of mainstream media.
Well,
then what's the point?
You know, I did get on Pacifica several times, and in the Bay Area, you know, which was,
no, you should have been on more. That's
well,
what it,
really,
it's no
yeah.
excuse. We should have had all the same type of times that they're going to give everybody else, and
NPR,
particularly
though,
for
wouldn't put me on.
Yeah,
you know, that was just like right down the street from me. But you know what I am observing about media is, I started this like way after you did, Rosa. It wasn't until April 4th, 2004, when Casey was killed, that I really started to pay attention. I used to think when George Bush was president that the media was right-wing. And now that Obama's president, you know, I'm thinking that the media isn't left-wing or right-wing. It just supports the establishment. And that there's only pretend opposition. It's like when George Bush was president, MSNBC and people like Keith Olbermann were the pretend opposition. Now that Obama's president, it's Fox. And they're the pretend opposition to Obama. But what it is that I watched Keith Olbermann last night, who's on MSNBC, say that George Will, a columnist saying that we need to leave Afghanistan, he's talking about cutting and running. Well, Keith Olbermann
right.
never would have said that when Bush was president. You know, so but it's the same policies, but Fox should be supporting Obama and saying, yay, we have this wonderful president who's continuing the violence of the empire that we supported under Bush. And MSNBC and Keith Olbermann should be going, hey, wait a minute, we don't support Obama because he's acting just like Bush did.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with you on that. You know, maybe there is no left media. You know, you know, especially as a woman of color, like, we are not represented. I mean, forget mainstream media, but even in independent progressive media, we're not, like, you know, equal in numbers on even Pacifica Network. You know, and that doesn't mean Pacifica or independent is not trying or that Democracy Now! Is not an amazing show. I think what it means is that you're right in terms of, I think a lot of them are helping to uphold the empire. And my understanding of independent media coming out of the Battle of Seattle in 99 was that it is not to hold up the empire, you know. And I found that really problematic during the elections because, again, I think you cannot misinform people. You know, so it still sticks with me. I need to see us, you know, who have been talking about single-payer health care to actually get on these shows. I mean, like, people like us have been talking about single-payer health care for 10 years. That's like nothing new. You know, we should be on there as pundits, too, if that's what some of us want to do. But, like, on Rachel Maddow's show, I need to see people like us.
Well, shut out us who we talk about peace. We talk about complete and total withdrawal. We talk about single-payer health care. We talk about, you know, universal university education that's free and accessible for everybody. They want to marginalize us and make us seem crazy when we're talking about the most logical things in the world.
Right.
So they're not going to put our voices on because that would challenge and put the Obama administration into a bad light.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that makes it difficult for people to negotiate, how do we protest the president, the policies, you know, how do we do that, is what the right wing has done with these town hall meetings, which I actually think, again, subjectively, what they're doing is what they're achieving a goal. And they're doing a good job at doing that.
Right.
And people say they're crazy. And yes, they are. But you know what? They're very organized. They have networks. And you know, we should maybe not be in that debate, in that type of protest. But we have every right to be protesting this, what's going on in Afghanistan right now. Like, if anything, that should be one of the main things. Or I'm shocked at the fact that nobody has questioned President Obama about Hurricane Katrina,
mm-hmm.
and that he didn't even mention the fourth year commemorative. It's just almost like if we don't put his feet to the fire, as not because we didn't vote for him, but because he's representing us and this is where money is going to and all that, then I think, you know, it's going to be a hard 3.5 years, you know, in this, there are going to be things that people think they were going to get, and they're not. And people don't read the bill because his health care plan, really, if everything he said happens, and it's fantastic, which is not when you read the whole bill, it doesn't kick into 2013.
Right.
And you got to think about somebody that makes such a calculated move. You know, they'll kick in after he's elected into the second presidency. And people are dying right now. And because Cynthia has made this public, Cynthia McKinney's aunt just passed away due to a major medical.
Right, and our hearts
you know,
go out to her.
And she just sent out the letter publicly to
right.
people. And the things going on with healthcare, we're talking about people's lives on a daily basis. And, yes, we know Cynthia, and we know people in our families are affected by lack of health care. You know, I call it death care. They might as well just say they're waiting for all of us to, you know, just so at the end we're okay. You know, it's ridiculous that we're even putting numbers into this. It's universal health care. Health care is a human right, and that's where the movement needs to mobilize. It's not negotiable anymore. It's
a human right.
Even
the weak public option that they were proposing is now off the table to what Obama says to appease Republicans, but what it really is to fulfill, you know, his
pharmaceutical money.
What he owes to pharmaceuticals and to health insurance companies. Well, Rose, unfortunately, we're out of time. This has been a great conversation. I hope you come back soon and, you know, can
people get a hold of you? Is there a way that my listeners can get a hold of you?
Oh, sure. Yeah, very easy. Either Facebook. I have a lot of new friends, thanks to Cindy, from different parts of the world. I love it. And it's ClementeRosa@gmail.com. And I'm home all the time working and writing my book, so I'd love to hear from people. And I just really thank you for the opportunity. And I really think if me, you, and Cynthia and people like us go out there together in the future, I mean, three great women. I always say a white woman, a black woman, and a Puerto Rican woman. What else do you want in the movement?
We got it all. We got it all.
Thank you to you guys and the producers and the audience. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you, Rosa, and we'll talk to you soon. That was Rosa Clemente, hip-hop scholar and vice presidential candidate in 2008. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. When we come back, I'll be doing my rant. Stay tuned. You're listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox here at CindySheehanSoapbox.com and Rational Radio, 1360 AM, Dallas, Texas.
We demand transparency. The Conference on Peace, Truth, and a New Economics, happening in New York City this 9/11 anniversary.
Come interact with the top experts on 9/11, the mystery of the anthrax attacks, and the real history of the Bush family.
We demand transparency.
What does the USA really stand for?
Why are the American people not allowed to know where their bailout dollars went?
Why can't the city of New York have a real investigation of the 9/11 attacks? Come help demand government transparency.
Come help create a time of peace.
We demand transparency. The Conference on Peace, Truth, and a New Economics.
New York City, September 12th and 13th. WeDemandTransparency.com.
What was that again?
WeDemandTransparency.com.
Cindy Sheehan's new booklet, Myth America, examines two distinct groups of people that clearly show that we are not all in this together, as President Obama declared. The first group, the robber class, are wealthy victimizers such as those corporations and politicians that profit off the hard labor of others through economic theft and violent exploitation. The second group, the robbed class, are the victims, such as those who work multiple jobs just to make ends meet, those who send their children off to die in robber class wars, those who lack proper health care, those who are denied decent education, and those who lose their jobs and homes and become homeless. Myth America exposes America's robber class, which controls our government, and affirms that we, the robbed class, can only be robbed if we allow it. To obtain a copy of Myth America and learn how we can take back our country, please visit CindySheehansSoapbox.com.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you're listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.CindySheehanSoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.CindySheehanSoapbox.com.
Thanks for staying tuned to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox here at CindySheehanSoapbox.com and Rational Radio, 1360 AM, Dallas, Texas. My rant today is called Keep the Change. If George Bush is a war criminal, then Obama is a war criminal. If Obama is not, then Bush is not. We the people can't have it both ways. I said that on Martha's Vineyard last week. Through many difficulties we faced on Martha's Vineyard, the sad passing of Senator Kennedy, Tropical Storm Danny, and even getting my wallet stolen last week, a hearty band of about two dozen of us from off the island and on tried our damnedest to revive some kind of anti-war sentiment in this nation. The media wanted to make it a story about the media, about how Crawford was such a big story and how Martha's Vineyard is not. I don't think that was the story, though. Even though we received endorsements from three of the most effective national anti-war groups, Veterans for Peace, Iraq Vets Against the War, and Rural Can't Wait, and about a dozen others from smaller groups, the large groups that supported the anti-Bush, anti-war message of Camp Casey and Crawford were missing in action physically and spiritually from the actions on Martha's Vineyard. The New York Times ran an article on Sunday claiming that after a long period of dormancy, the, quote, anti-war movement, end quote, was getting restive and planned to do some actions in October around the 8th anniversary of the invasion of Afghanistan. Well, some of us have been restive and working for years, and the groups that are now becoming restive are the very ones that let the war genie out of the bottle and will have a lot of problems putting it back in if that is really the intention of these groups. The restive anti-war movement is planning teach-ins and memorials, but not planning on surrounding the White House and demanding that their leader bring the troops home from all theaters of war and then threatening to withhold support if he doesn't. The restive anti-war movement will not do anything it thinks will compromise Democratic chances in the 2010 midterms. I have two questions to ask of the restive anti-war movement. First question, how did the people of Iraq, Afghanistan lose value as human beings when the Democrats took over power in 2007? Second question, how did the people of Pakistan lose their value as human beings when Obama became president at the beginning of the year? The born-again restive anti-war movement allowed the Democratic Party to suck the wind out of our sails in 2007, and it's almost like we will have to start from scratch. Give him a chance, they say. He's better than McCain, they say. If you question him, then you're a racist, they say. I say, go to Iraq AFPAC and tell these things to the people who are being drone bombed for simply having the nerve to want to get married. Give him a chance for what? No thanks. Keep the change. My Ask Cindy question today comes from Floyd Rudman. And Floyd is writing from Norway, and he says, good morning. I write from North Norway. I want to thank you for your continuing efforts to stop these wars. Soon, hopefully, Americans will realize that they cannot afford war. Then maybe we will stop. Sincerely, Floyd Rudman. Well, Floyd, you have a very good point there. When over $1 trillion a year is sucked up by the military-industrial complex and the human cost is immeasurable, we can't afford to allow our leaders to go forward with these disastrous foreign policies. I'm for single-payer health care. I'm for free universal university education. I'm for housing for all, good-paying jobs for everybody. But until we break the cycle of violence and about paying for violence, none of these things will be possible. Well, that's the soapbox for today. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you liked listening to our guest, Rosa Clemente. We had a very fascinating conversation. She's a very brilliant woman. I'd like to thank Rosa for being on today. I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, my co-producer, Mikey, and, of course, you for listening, as always. We're going to close the show today with some words from one of my favorite anarchists, Emma Goldman, and we're going to hear a little bit about her life. Thanks for listening again. This is Cindy Sheehan. You're listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox at cindysheehansoapbox.com and Rational Radio, 1360 AM, Dallas, Texas.
Emma Goldman, the famous anarchist leader, has returned to the United States after an exile of 15 years.
I'm delighted to be back in the United States. My hunting ground of 35 years. The country where I had my innings in the social and economic struggle, and where I decided to devote myself to the presentation of anarchism, a social philosophy which aims at the emancipation, economic, social, political, and spiritual, of the human race.
Emma Goldman was perhaps the best known of the many immigrant anarchists who had come from countries all over Europe. Italians, Russians, Germans, and Spaniards had been converted to the ideas of anarchism first preached by the Russians Michael Bakunin and Peter Kropotkin.
The immigrant anarchists envisioned a world without leaders, a system of mutual aid made up of interlocking federations and communes. The anarchists hoped their persistent educational efforts would pay off when the working classes would spontaneously rise up and overthrow their oppressors. These immigrants created a whole self-contained culture with their own schools, colonies, newspapers, and publications.
Together with other immigrant groups, they led anti-war protests during the First World War and were active in fighting the rising tide of fascism during the 1930s and 40s. And they were also the prime targets of government repression, earmarked for wholesale arrests, deportation, and lifelong harassment.
What do you think about Russia, Miss Goldman?
I consider Russia and America the most interesting countries in the world today.
How about Hitler?
I don't know him and don't want to.
What is your opinion of Italy?
Beautiful country minus Mussolini.
Ms. Goldman, should the government here object to your speeches of anarchism, would you change them or leave the country?
I will leave the country rather than deny my ideas. I prefer to stick to my gun.
I must make my witness. Have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
There's yelling in Baton Rouge.